You are tuned into Lightly on the Ground Radio, produced at Richmond Independent Radio and broadcast on WRIR LP 97.3 FM and worldwide at WRIR.org. We're exploring our food system, which includes everything from farm to table. It extends from a seed in a farmer's hand to the bill in the hands of those making policy on local, national, and worldwide front. And we focus on the factors that each guest brings to growing and sustaining our food system. While we're talking local, the ideas are pertinent to any food system, and this conversation is part of a series on the future of farming. And our guest today, Anthony Flaccovento, has a deep and wide history in the future of and in the past of farming in Virginia. Welcome to WRIR, Anthony.
Thanks. And first off, let me say thanks so much for this opportunity. It's great to be on the radio with you and talking to folks in the Richmond area, and I imagine in many parts of the Commonwealth. It's great. Yeah. I'm running for Congress in part because of what I want to stop. And among the many things I'd like to see ended, the first is that I was calling it the trickle-up of wealth, but really, somebody pointed out to me, it's more like it's being sucked up. And that's really what's been happening for most of the last 32 years. Ronald Reagan promised a trickle-down economy, where if we just gave enough breaks to a small group of corporations and very well-to-do individuals, prosperity would gradually trickle down to the middle class and even to low-income people. And the interesting and unfortunate thing is it's been almost exactly the opposite. It's been 32 years of wealth, of income, of ownership, and of prosperity just being sucked up out of homeowners and small businesses, out of family farms, and most fundamentally out of communities. So this idea of trickle-down, the idea that we give a small group of people that some folks call job creators all these breaks, and then the rest of us ride their coattails, it just ain't so. We know it isn't. It hasn't worked. It hasn't worked in this country or other countries that have tried it. What is working, and what I've been involved with, a lot of other people too, is this idea of building a bottom-up economy, building a food system, rebuilding small towns and city centers, and out of that rebuilding of local community, we begin to create a prosperity that's more widely shared. Prosperity that's based more on meeting real needs for people, and prosperity that's durable, as some folks call it. A lot of our prosperity that we've had has been fleeting. People or companies have perhaps come in with a new product, or we have wooed big businesses to small towns, and they've stayed for 5, 7, 10 years, and then when they get a better break, a better tax incentive package, they pick up and leave. And when you build a bottom-up economy, when you build a locally rooted food system, you're investing in people who live there, people whose roots are there, people whose grandparents, ancestors, and children are there. And that's a very stable sort of prosperity, not a fleeting prosperity.
It is. Now, I've been aware of what you're doing out in that area, and I'd like to hear a little bit of this sort of in a storied mode, where you're talking about the individuals that you've affected and the Appalachian sustainable development and the people that you've brought into it, some examples of how these ideas, which are clearly focused, how you've helped to build some of that prosperity.
You know, when we started working on food issues back in the mid-90s, the small group of us that got together, we were all kind of doers rather than talkers. And so I started what was probably the first CSA in the region, Community Supported Agriculture, back in 1994.
Did you invent it?
No. Just the first one in this region.
Oh, okay.
People had been doing it in the Northeast and places like Japan and Denmark for a few years. Uh-huh. I had read about it and decided, well, this is an interesting idea. You line up a group of consumers who want to eat well, and you enter into an agreement to provide them a weekly basket of produce and other food. And they pay you some or all the money up front, and it's kind of everybody benefits. And of course, that idea that most people call CSAs has grown dramatically. But when I started that in 94, what I found quickly at that point, I did not own the farm that I own now. I just had a backyard garden. I could grow a lot in that garden, but not nearly enough. So the second year, I was, of necessity, started reaching out to other farmers to join me because the number of people who wanted the food was growing. And so I found a few Amish growers, found a couple of other folks who had moved to the area, and we started building this CSA. And eventually then we started selling to restaurants, and that group that we called Highlands Bio Produce was our first little foray into a local food system in this area. You know, it was very successful and we learned a great deal from it, but about 4 or 5 years in, it just hit me that every one of the growers in our little network, we had about a dozen growers by that point, were all imports to this region. We didn't have a single native Appalachian in the group. And I thought, you know, it's working, but on a small scale, we're kind of stuck. What could we do that would bring this sort of opportunity to a much broader group, not just, as I called it, the ponytail farmers, which is what we were, but how could we broaden that group? And just through stroke of luck, reached out to a group of tobacco farmers who were in Scott and Lee County with the idea, if you grow some healthy produce organically, we'll help you learn, but if you grow it, we will sell it to supermarkets and restaurants and universities. And this was the little bit of an idea that started the Appalachian Harvest Growers Network. We took that idea to the farmers. Most were reluctant. They'd been growing tobacco their whole lives. The idea of organic was somewhere between mysterious and repulsive to them. So we didn't have like a real great reception that first meeting, but two people came up. A fellow named Martin Miles was one of them, and he came up and he said, you know, tobacco's been going down for a while. I'm willing to give this a try. A couple weeks later, I traveled locally, but also made a trip to Richmond, Virginia, and met with some produce buyers for a locally based chain there, and basically took some samples from my farm and said, would you buy this if we can grow it and this kind of quality? And the buyers loved it. They jumped on it. They mm-hmm. said, if you can grow this, and you can grow a lot of it, like 100 boxes a week or 200 boxes a week, then we'll do business with you. And so putting all those pieces together, the farmers, the production, the markets, and then the part in between, the infrastructure to get everything ready for market, is what we did over the next 2 or 3 years, eventually leading to the Appalachian Harvest Growers Network that allows somewhere between 50 and 75 farmers to sell to supermarkets and colleges. It's essentially an old-fashioned co-op, but it's driven by specific demand from specific buyers, and all of that is then coordinated. So when the farmers plant their tomatoes or their peppers or their zucchini or their cucumbers, they know that there's a buyer to purchase it at the other end.
And you're speaking in present tense still. So you started it in 1995?
Well, 1995 was the little experiment,
yeah,
the Highlands Bio Produce, and then Appalachian Harvest, the sort of larger version that was run by Appalachian Sustainable Development, started in 2000.
Uh-huh.
And that is very much still going. I've grown for it every year as just a producer, except this year. This year with the campaign, I'm still doing my farm, but I had to cut the farm back substantially, and so we're not growing. My wife and I are not growing for the Appalachian Harvest Network, but it's still going strong. Lots of farmers from multiple counties growing a wide range of produce and also free-range eggs.
That's exciting. It shows that you can start with the grassroots and you can make change, and it just blows my hair back.
That's a good way to put it.
So,
you know, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The ingredient in this, the other key ingredient, was the idea of community capital. We started calling it that after we had already built it. At first, we were just saying, well, we need trucks and we need coolers and we need loading docks. And we started piecing all that together, like most things, by the seat of our pants. It actually started out in an old tobacco barn. That same farmer, Martin Miles, who was one of the first tobacco farmers to give this a try, he had a lot of space in his tobacco barn because he was growing much less tobacco. And he said, well, I'll give you a little space. You set up shop there. That grew, and eventually we moved beyond the barn, and now we have a 15,000 square foot packing facility with with walking coolers, with forced air coolers, with grading lines, loading docks, refrigerated trucks. All of that was purchased with a combination of grants and loans, both sort of traditional private money and some public investment. And the amazing thing is that the amount of money that went into that facility is what I would call a great bang for the buck, because scores of farmers can use this one facility. Scores of farmers can bring truckloads of produce and eggs, have them cooled, graded, labeled, shipped, and it is so much more cost effective to do it as a group in a coordinated way than it would be for each one of the 50 or 60 farmers to have his own truck and his own packing house and his own cooler. So this idea of investing in the community as community capital is another, I think, fundamental idea behind this bottom-up economy.
You're listening to Lightly on the Ground Radio, and our guest today in the live room at WRIR is Anthony Flaccovento. He's running for Congress in Virginia's 9th District this year. Anthony, I did want to ask you about the 2012 Agriculture Reform Food and Jobs Act, also known as the Farm Bill. What is your take on that this year?
There's a Senate version and a House version, and, yeah. And now the House version, they were talking about passing a stopgap that would have made some dramatic cuts to conservation programs and completely eliminated organic programs. It looks like they've pulled that, so they're still at the negotiating table between the Senate and the House version. You know, the short take, you can get really lost in the weeds on those farm bill discussions because the farm bill is so big.
It is.
But an easy way to think about the farm bill for the average consumer is as having kind of three components. It really has dozens and dozens. One is food stamps. Food stamps is this, or SNAP as it's now called, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Mm-hmm. That's the single biggest part of the Farm Bill. And of course, food stamps have grown over the last 3 years, primarily because a whole lot of people qualify now that didn't a few years ago because of all the unemployment. But food stamps are the biggest part. The remaining two pieces you can think of as being kind of traditional commodity agriculture: corn, soybeans, wheat, sugar, cotton, a few other grains, and then everything else. And it's in that everything else that we've been making some headway the last few years. And when I say we, I mean people like myself, local farmers in Virginia, neighboring states, who are trying to build a healthier local regional food system. Things like the organic transition program that helps farmers with a little bit of cost share for their transition from conventional to organic. Things like the farmers market promotion program that has helped us grow from 1,700 farmers markets in the mid-90s to over 7,000 last year. Things like the SNAP farmers market program that now allows people on food stamps to use their electronic benefit card at local farmers markets and helps the farmers market set that up so they can take those. Many, many, many good programs that help farmers be more profitable, help people, especially lower income people and senior citizens, eat better and create, we're finding out, a lot of good economic return along the way. We have been making progress over the last 10 years. For the first time, USDA really spending some time and attention on those programs. That's the good news. The bad news is, with all the talk of budget cuts and with the shift to, I would call people like my opponent and others in Congress who seem to want to put all of their eggs in the basket of the well-to-do, we now stand to lose a lot of those gains in local foods, in access to affordable food for low-income people, and in healthier eating for consumers. It's really a critical time for people everywhere, people who shop at farmers markets, people who believe in better eating, to call their representative and say, don't dismantle the gains we've made in organic and sustainable farming and in local food systems. It's some of the best things going.
Yeah, I just saw a list of foods that are acceptable for the WIC program, Women's Infants and Children program.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You can't have organic, you can't have freshly ground peanut butter, you can only have store brands. And some of the things, really, it really limits the choice of a conscious consumer, even though they're very dependent upon that small amount of money that they get, they can't use it for truly wholesome foods.
Right. The WIC program takes a very different approach than the SNAP program. The SNAP program is much, much, much broader. It does not specify foods or brands. It simply eliminates a few things from consideration. Basically, you can't have ready-to-eat foods.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, a lot of people over the years and still to this day get their hair on end if they see somebody in the supermarket using food stamps or SNAP benefits to buy what they consider to be junk food, potato chips or Coca-Cola, or if they see them buying something like steaks. And certainly some of that happens. But the truth is, food stamps are a pretty modest benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And for most people, it's scaled both to how much income you have and how many children you have. And when you break it down, it is not a luxury benefit. So I think most people do their best to use it wisely. The problem has been that many people on food stamps are in communities where they don't have access to a lot of healthy food options. And that's why this movement towards farmers markets and using food stamps in farmers markets has been such a terrific thing. There are hundreds of people in local markets in Virginia using their food stamps to buy fresh produce, even organic produce.
Mm-hmm.
We get quite a few customers at our organic booth. Healthy meats and eggs. There's a lot of people doing it. There's thousands around the country. And it's all part of this very entrepreneurial spirit that's going on around local food. It's not just farmers markets. You now have people with bodegas and little mobile grocers in certain cities
mm-hmm.
that are taking produce and other healthy foods into poor neighborhoods and finding that people want it. So again, it's all part of an effort to do this bottom-up economy, I'll say it again, where you're not so much taking what some advertiser or corporation tells you you need, but you're taking stock as a community of people and saying, what do we need, and how much of that can we produce ourselves, and how can we fill those needs close to home? That's kind of the essence of it, and it's happening all over the country.
But you say this is one of the things that might be endangered if the farm bill goes a certain way. It could be axed.
It could be axed or dramatically cut. I mean, certainly this this proposition to extend certain parts of the farm bill in order to provide drought assistance to the farmers suffering out west completely eliminated funding for organic programs and greatly reduced or limited funding for a lot of other local food programs. Again, fortunately, that idea was pulled, but there are certainly members of Congress who would just as soon see the conservation programs greatly diminished and would like to see the gains we've had in the local food system cut way back. It's part of a vision that says, again, big farms, big business, a few big players will give us what we need if we just cut them some slack, reduce their regulatory burden, give them some more tax breaks, and it'll all trickle down. And it just hasn't worked. It's not right. It's not fair. And we know that the alternative is more cost effective. It creates more self-reliant people and communities. And it really cultivates this entrepreneurial spirit. We're seeing it all over the place. I think that what needs to happen is the millions of consumers who've grown to love local foods, they're the ones, not just this small group of farmers who've been fighting this battle for a long time. It's the millions of consumers who need to be on the phone and emailing their congresspersons and saying, not only do we not want to lose this, this is where we want the farm economy to grow.
Yeah, some of the analogies you used are so apt. The trickle-down idea, where you're talking about the money actually not trickling down, it's very parallel with the fact that the water is running out. We're not going to have the water trickling down the way we used to. And that's part of the problem we're having with the commodities out west, is that there's not enough water to actually make them come up out of the ground and succeed. Whereas if our food is being grown locally and with discrete amounts of water and being taken care of in a sustainable manner with lots of mulch and that sort of thing, we'll have more food closer to home and not be so dependent upon the water and the huge infrastructure, I would think.
Yeah, I think it's partly that. And of course, a lot of people will say, and you hear it right to this day, well, organic's great. That's good for a few farmers. They can make a little more money. And that's good for some boutique markets where the foodies can come and have their food needs fulfilled. But if we went organic, yields would drop by 50% and we'd have starvation. The truth of it is, that the organic and sustainable food movement, including the whole area of pasture-based or grass-based livestock management, has shown, as it has grown in knowledge and experience, it has shown that it can be of equal or greater productivity, particularly under stress. So organic farming systems, for instance, research out of USDA and Rodale both shows that organic farming systems for grains like corn and wheat and soybeans do well overall. They're competitive to conventional systems, but they do far better during drought years. They do far better when there's less water. And that makes sense, because the essence of an organic system is you build up more soil organic matter. And when you do that, you can hold on to more moisture. So that we've had this idea that organic and sustainable is a little boutique for a small group, but real farming is commodity farming with lots of irrigation and lots of nitrogen fertilizer and pest control products. Well, we know that we can gradually make a transition, if not to purely organic, where those systems are far more sustainable, using far less inputs, and producing better outcomes, both for the farms, the environment, and for people. You know, Joel Salatin's farm in Swope, Virginia, is a great example of one where he uses virtually none of the inputs to keep his pasture healthy that traditional farmers would use. And yet, at the same time, he has more productivity per acre of land than a traditional farm, much more productivity. It's analogous to what we keep saying about the economy. If we invest in the people, the businesses, the farms, the local community, build on our strengths instead of just thinking that we have to always bring in somebody from outside, we won't just get nice tourist destinations downtown. We'll actually get more bang for the buck. We'll get stronger economies with more and better jobs. That's what we're beginning to realize is true, not just in the farming sector, but in the economy as a whole.
You can't outsource truck driving and getting the food out of the fields and into the market. You can't really send those kind of jobs overseas.
Right.
Yeah. So the main question I had for you is, what is the future of farming? And it seems like you've really kind of sketched that out for us. But if you had changes that you would suggest at this point on a national level, like presume you were on the Agriculture Committee of the U.S. Congress.
Well, if I get in, that would certainly be one I would put my hat in the ring for, and I think I'd be a good candidate for with my experience, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe two or three points. One is, don't backpedal. Don't backtrack on the progress we've been making in just beginning to build a healthy and sustainable food system. After several years of progress, we still give far, far less money to organic and sustainable farming and local foods than we give to commodities. Right now, after 10 years of progress, the total amount of all those local food and organic programs amounts to less than a dime on a dollar for commodity payments to corn, soybean, and wheat growers. So we're not asking for much. We're just asking to continue that progress. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is, we really need to invest in infrastructure. What helps drive this is a good venue to sell, like a farmer's market, a slaughterhouse for local meat production to be able to meet USDA standards and sell to markets.
How about an abattoir on wheels?
An abattoir on wheels, which has worked in a number of places. It doesn't work everywhere, but in some of the areas where farmers are really spread out, absolutely, those mobile facilities are great. A packing house like we did in Scott County, Virginia. That type of infrastructure and many, many others that are springing up. Again, as I say, what it does is it capitalizes many farmers, many entrepreneurs at once, rather than having to make individual loans or grants to dozens or hundreds. So I think the infrastructure, the community capital, is the second key point. And the third, which again, we're making progress, but we need to accelerate it, is we've got to get young people in farming. This has started on our farm. We mm-hmm. have had both paid workers, full-time farm managers, and woofers, the worldwide workers on organic farms, for almost 10 years. And we have seen it, and other farmers have seen it. There's a lot of young folks interested in farming. They want to learn it. They want to give it a try. We need to support them in that. They won't all become farmers, but those who want to try, who want to learn, whether they've never farmed or whether they're a generation or two removed from a farming family. They need the training, they need the housing, they need the low interest loan money to help start their own operations, because people like me are getting old and we've really got to have this next generation of young folks moving into farming. I think those would be my three priorities.
Well, you certainly stated them clearly, Anthony Flacavento. Tell us briefly where we could reach you if we had questions. And
Sure. As you know, and as you said at the opening, I'm now running for Congress, I'm the Democratic nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 9th District. So two things people can do. They can go to our website. They can learn about my campaign, but they'll also learn about me and be able to contact me through there. The easiest handle for the website is A, like Anthony, A for 9, A-F-O-R, the number 9. .com. The other thing to do, I think, is to stay tuned to the mailings and the information provided by Virginia Association for Biological Farming, people like Mark Schoenbeck, who keep folks closely abreast of what's happening not only on the farm bill, but what's happening in the sustainable farming scene throughout Virginia.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you for putting a plug in there for the VABF and for Mark Schoenbeck personally. It's time to wrap this up. I want to thank everyone for listening to Lightly on the Ground Radio, a production of Richmond Independent Radio. Any closing words there, Anthony? You've got about 3 seconds.
I think the future is kind of in our hands, and we need people to take a hold of it and really support this idea of a healthy bottom-up economy and food system.
All right. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you.
Thank you.